Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So yesterday was a perfect example of the political gridlock in our country these days. The House put a two-month Band-Aid on transportation funding because they can't agree on anything more long-term. And they passed Paul Ryan's Republican budget that mostly privatizes Medicare and has no chance of getting through the Senate, not to mention the polarization reflected in the Supreme Court hearing on the health reform law this week and the fallout from that. And it should only get worse this year, with the sides dug in on the big questions of Medicare, Social Security, defense spending, and the Bush tax rates. If only President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner had come to that $4 trillion grand bargain on it all that they almost cut last summer. In Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Matt Bai will have a major investigative article on how that deal, so tantalizingly close, broke down at the last minute. Who really killed it, the Speaker or the President? Melinda Henneberger is here, too, thinking about politics after the Supreme Court showdown. She blogs at the She the People blog for The Washington Post. Hi, Matt. Hi, Melinda. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hello.
Hey, Brian.
Melinda, do you think it matters to the president's reelection how the Supreme Court rules on the health reform law, or are the legal and political realms totally separate here?
Well, I don't think the political realm is ever totally separate, but, you know, you don't hear the usual woo-hooing that, from liberals, from Democrats over, well, you know, if we lose the health care bill, at least this will be very invigorating and exciting, and, you know, it'll certainly turn out the base. I think this is actually the rare instance where they'd rather keep the law than have the issue. I mean, I think people are very disheartened by what it sounded like, and even though you can never tell for sure how the justices are going to decide, I mean, it didn't look, the questioning was certainly very harsh. And I think people are really reeling about, you know, what the consequences would be if we have to walk it back after that, you know, the years it took, the decades it took to get this thing through in the first place.
On the other hand, Matt, Ross Douthat, conservative New York Times columnist, wrote this week that it could help the president if the law is struck down because it would kill the popular things in it, like no denials of insurance based on pre-existing conditions and allowing young adults to remain on their parents' family plans until they're 26 if the whole law is struck down. And the Republicans have no plan for replacing things like this. Do you buy that argument at all?
I don't, Brian. I love Ross, but I think I'm going to disagree on this one because, and I'll tell you why I disagree. It's a more macro point for me, which is the history of really transformative social legislation like this, and there haven't been much like this, as you know, in decades, is that there's a very tenuous window. Once it becomes an entitlement, all this stuff kicks in and they really get used to the law, the exchanges kick in, all of that, you know, then the history suggests that people really never want to touch it or get rid of it, even when it would be beneficial to modernize it, perhaps. But there's a period of time before all the benefits kick in, before people really get acclimated to this as part of their lives, where all they really see is government doing a lot of big, expensive stuff, and they're not quite sure how it's going to shake out, and it makes them anxious. And even though some of these things that you mentioned are part of the law already, I don't think, and I think the polling suggests this is true too, that Americans have really warmed to this, or that they really you know, feel this is an indispensable part of the social safety net at this point. And so you know, any time I think that the president has to spend talking about or defending this law is not useful time for him politically, because until this law is fully phased in, I don't think it's going to have the hold on the public that Ross suggested does.
But how much of an issue, Melinda, do you think it actually becomes if it is struck down in whole or in part, if Romney is the nominee, considering his similar law with a similar mandate in Massachusetts?
Well, that's absolutely right. I think it would still have the effect of motivating the Democratic base. And I think that on the left, there's certainly a lot of support, and there would be a lot of anger if this is struck down. So I do think it would have a political impact and would work in the president's favor because, as you say, you know, this really was Romney care before it was so-called Obamacare. But, you know, people are benefiting already from this law. I mean, especially with preventive services and, yes, with people being on their parents' insurance until they're 26 years old. I mean, I think that seniors getting discounts on 50% discounts on drugs, I mean, you really are starting to see the results already. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, the parts of the law that wouldn't kick in for another 2 years, the reason that, you know, Republicans wanted to delay that the time as long as possible before it kicks in is obvious.
Melinda Henneberger from The Washington Post, Matt Bai from The New York Times, and Matt, your article coming in the magazine this Sunday on the grand bargain goes into fascinating detail on how that grand debt reduction bargain almost came together last summer between Boehner and Obama, complete with tax hikes that the Republicans didn't want and Medicare and Social Security cuts that the Democrats didn't want, but at the last minute it broke down. And one thing you discuss was that Boehner seemed ready to agree to an $800 billion tax hike as part of the deal, and then close to the last minute, the White House pushed the number to more than $1 trillion, a deal breaker, according to Boehner. What actually happened with that part of it?
Well, it's interesting, and thank you. Thank you for your kind words about the piece and for taking the amount of time required to get through it.
I did. It was 21 pages when I printed it out, but I did read the whole thing.
I have heard that repeatedly. You just got to read it online so you don't think about it as much. It's interesting. What happened there is different from what I expected and different from what's been said and certainly different from what the speaker has said over time, which is it is true that the president asked for more money. It is true he put, late in the process, that he put the speaker in a very difficult position and that the deal fell apart. But what we didn't know, what I didn't know until going into it much, much deeper, is that the speaker actually, for him, that was not a deal breaker. In fact, he did consider a way of meeting the president at that higher number at the end, and it would have almost certainly meant raising people's taxes and going back on what he had been telling his caucus. He very badly wanted a deal and I think was absolutely willing to risk his speakership to get it. In the end, it was his number two in the caucus, Eric Cantor, speaking presumably on behalf of other leaders in the caucus, who said, you know, I'm not going to support this, and I guarantee you the caucus isn't going to support this. And I think Boehner found himself in a box where moving ahead, it would have been okay if it meant risking his speakership, but he was really going to be throwing his speakership away, and he could not do that. And he blames the president. He's very angry for the president for putting him in that position. But the idea that this revenue was a non-starter to him personally is just not true.
So was that the revelation? You mentioned that there's a revelation about Boehner's thinking in the article that contradicts his publicly stated version of the breakdown, even what he told some of his own aides. Was that that?
It is. I hope that would have been clearer. but it is. I mean, he has said for many, many months, his story has been, as I say in the piece, that revenue was a deal breaker, that the president wanted more money, and he said from the start that was never going to happen, and he walked away as a result. That just was not the case. And I think there are a lot of people in the Republican caucus and even in the Republican leadership who believe this to be the case. But the fact, even if it's not politically convenient for the speaker, is that it was not a non-starter, and that he still tried right up to the very end to find a way to make a deal, even if it meant increasing that revenue number.
I'm curious about Eric Cantor, who you mentioned, the conservative young deputy to Boehner, who actually got a seat at the table in those negotiations, Republican congressman from Virginia. I want to play a clip of Cantor yesterday endorsing this Ryan budget, the Republican budget that came out, that turns Medicare into a privatized system and does all these other things. This is Cantor yesterday.
Our budget takes bold steps that will get the fiscal house in order and will manage down the debt and deficit.
Could Eric Cantor have been saying that about this grand bargain last summer, or was he only ever in the room to kill it rather than negotiate it?
You know, I think the answer to that is complicated, and Cantor's an interesting guy. I mean, it would appear on the surface to a lot of people who think a deal is a good idea that he was simply being obstructionist, that he was in the room to kill it. And it is true that he never favored doing a deal and warned repeatedly to Boehner that he didn't think the White House could be trusted, and in the end was probably the person most responsible for killing the deal as it existed. You know, but Cantor has his reasons, and I don't think they're invalid reasons for a party leader, for someone with his responsibilities. He felt, I think, that that deal, not only did he on principle not want to increase taxes, but I think he felt the deal couldn't pass the House, and I think there are a lot of Democrats and some in the White House who agreed with him. He felt it was going to be very bad for the party to have its leadership out there asking for more revenue at a moment when you had this Tea Party rebellion. He feared a third-party breakaway, and he feared a certain defeat in the presidential election, all of which I think are very valid concerns. You could certainly argue, and perhaps I would, that the public welfare, if you could get a deal that was good for both sides and that would have changed the fiscal trajectory of the country, would have outweighed party political concerns, partisan concerns, and that's a great ideal. But these guys have other responsibilities too, and I think that the objections Cantor raised, whether or not they were in the best interests of the country ultimately, were certainly valid ones for him to be thinking about, and I think we're not simply reactionary partisan concerns.
Matt Bye from the New York Times. His article, Who Killed the Debt Deal, will be in Sunday's magazine. Melinda Henneberger from the Washington Post. And Melinda, the House did pass that revolutionary Paul Ryan budget yesterday, complete with privatizing most of Medicare and ending Medicaid as health care for the poor, as a federal entitlement. We heard Eric Cantor in that clip crowing about this, but this has no chance of getting through the Senate. So why do such an in-your-face bill that has no chance?
Well, for political reasons, to say, you know, this is who we are, this is what we do. We are, our agenda is all about, you know, so-called simplifying the tax code. What I think is so interesting is, you know, looking at what the simplified tax code would do. I mean, it would if you just bring the tax code, the upper limit, down from 35 to 25, the way they want to do, I mean, that would really be, and they say it would be revenue neutral. It really would be devastating for middle-income Americans. I mean, it would really be a huge increase for those people.
But you don't know that. I mean, I saw Paul Ryan. I was actually amazed by this answer, and I'd be curious to get both of your comments on it. But I saw Ryan on one of the Sunday talk shows, I think it was Fox News Sunday, last weekend, and he was asked, okay, you say this is going to be revenue neutral. In other words, you lower the rates, but you close a lot of the loopholes. So in toto, the government theoretically gets the same amount of money to run the country. But then he was asked, I'm pretty sure it was Chris Wallace asking on Fox News Sunday, who's going to pay more? And who's going to pay less if you rejigger it all like that? And Ryan said, I don't know. There's no way to know. And I thought, come on. Could you go to the trouble of reducing tax rates so dramatically and saying you're going to close all these major loopholes? And we know what the deductions are, home mortgage interest, the deduction for giving employees health insurance, all these big things that actually affect our lives. Who's going to pay more? Who's going to pay less? I don't know. I couldn't believe it.
Here they're saying the whole point of this is stability. You know, the Republican agenda equals stability. We need stability, and we need to be able to plan. But this would cause massive instability, it seems.
Why do you come to the conclusion that it would hurt the middle class?
Because if you're bringing the top rate down, where is the money going to come from? It would come from people who are paying less now, it would seem, if that's what they're saying.
Right. Though, Matt, in theory, if you close the major deductions and wealthier people pay more of the deductions because they make more money, so they have more of the deductions to take, right? If you make $50,000 a year,
yeah,
and you take your mortgage interest deduction, you're not getting nearly as much of a savings as if you make, as if you buy a $5 million house and take your mortgage interest deduction. It's just a lot more money. So one could argue that the top tax rate lowering benefit is going to go to the rich, but also the deduction eliminations are going to hurt the rich.
Yes, it depends on – it really is – it depends on the calculation of where you put the rate versus what you do with the deductions. Because, for instance, yeah, you get a lot of money back by, for instance, phasing out that mortgage interest deduction over a certain amount, you know, for a mortgage over $400,000 or $500,000 and, you know, on second homes. And that's certainly not affecting, middle-class families. So I think Melinda's essentially right that the money's got to come from somewhere if you're lowering the rate that much. But this gets to the issue of, you know, how dramatic – this kind of tax reform and how destabilizing it needs to be. I mean, part of when you look at, you know, the Ryan plan, which is dead on arrival in the Senate, when you look at this Bowles-Simpson bill, which went down, you know, heartily in the House, you know, we sort of get into the mindset, and I think it's bound to disappoint us and make us very frustrated, that you have to have this giant transformative recalculation of the federal budget, complete restructuring, in order to call it progress or bipartisan or to say we're making a difference. And I think one of the things you learn when you look at the specifics of what the president and the speaker had managed to agree on last year, even before the deal fell apart, is that, you know, I think there are incremental steps where there's a lot of common ground that would have a significant, not radical impact, but that would certainly do two things. It would start the nation, pivot the nation on a path toward more sustainability and less inequality, and also create some evidence and some groundwork for actual bipartisan cooperation. And those things were out there. They were 80, 85% of the way toward a deal. So I think to the extent that we focus all of our hope on something radical on either side, or even in the center of the system like Bowles-Simpson, I think that that's a setup for disappointment, because that's not actually how change happens. Mm. And there is a fair amount to be done in the sort of medium ground where there's a decent amount of agreement.
You could argue that they avoid the medium ground in order to avoid action, because it's so
true. I definitely argue that, Melinda. Yeah.
You definitely argue that, and the piece is right. In fact, you write at one point that you think Boehner was afraid to go back to Obama at the very last minute because Obama would have compromised, because Obama would have come off of that $1 trillion-plus tax increase and gone back to the acceptable $800 billion yeah. number, correct?
Yeah, and did. You know, I mean, to me, it was quite almost comedic. There's something very funny about that last 24 hours now that you have some distance from it if you weren't involved. Because it
if
is
you
like
don't care about
romantic,
the future of the country. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right. Because it's like this romantic breakup. You know, is he going to call? Should I call him back? Why isn't he calling? You know, and then, Boehner thinks, I don't want to call him because I'm afraid he'll ask me to come back and negotiate, and I don't want to negotiate. There was really this odd personal dynamic. And then in the end, Obama does exactly what you describe. He calls him back and says, can't we just go back to the way it was before, you know? And the speaker says, no, we can't. I mean, I don't want to paper over what were significant differences even in that original deal. I mean, Boehner wanted to raise that $800 billion in revenue theoretically by raising not a penny in new taxes, which I don't think ever would have flown with Democrats in Congress. So I think there was, there's a big fight, big fights to be had still. But there was quite a bit of agreement, and I think the problem exactly, as Melinda hints at, is, could either side get their parties to come to the middle ground, or do they prefer to have the issue? Do they prefer to have the fight to the progress? And I think it's fair to say, and I think, you have to, if you're going to come down in a judgment, it's very fair to say that the president got much further, was much more successful in getting at least his leadership around to that point of view than the speaker was in his own caucus.
Matt Bye from the New York Times, Melinda Henneberger from the Washington Post. Melinda, how similar would you say the Ryan Medicare plan is to the Obama health reform that went before the Supreme Court? To me, it looks very similar in some key ways. All seniors would buy health insurance plans.
They'd be mandated either, to buy it, right?
Right. Either private or the public Medicare package, which they would have to buy into, and government would subsidize the purchase based on income. Are they talking about the similarities between the two plans? And are Republicans being asked this week about, wait a minute, isn't this Ryan Medicare plan just like the Obama health reform that you hate?
I'm sure that's a rhetorical question, Brian. No, I don't think so. They wouldn't see it that way at all, though it is, as you say, a perfect mirror image. I standing out in front of the Supreme Court this week was just a surreal experience, with people describing a law that in ways that had no relationship I could see to reality. I mean, and this obsession with, what they call the broccoli argument, that if it's almost like, do they really fear vegetables? I mean, again and again saying, if they can mandate this, they can make us buy health food. They could stop us from eating steak. They could make us go to the gym. You know, yes, this would seem to have the exact same mechanism and the exact same mandate, but I wouldn't look to be hearing that from a lot on Fox News, let's say.
Matt, there, in theory, I guess, somebody could propose a grand bargain that says, let's have the Ryan plan for all Americans. Have it for seniors, and then have it for everybody else. It would be the Obama plan plus a public option, ironically, for everybody, you know, from birth to death. But I guess they wouldn't go for that grand bargain today, would they?
No, they wouldn't. And a lot of this comes down to trust. You know, everything you're talking about doing in this realm, really, it doesn't get hammered out on a piece of paper. It requires congressional committees and both parties to go back, work together, work off a specific set of principles, get it done, get it passed. And if it doesn't pass, you know, there have to be some penalties. And that that trust issue really becomes quite significant because neither side trusts the other to sort of make good on the principles they agree on because they have such radical interpretations, say the Obama plan, the Ryan plan, of what, you know, what that kind of reformation means in policy. You know, I'm not sure. I would take issue a little bit with what Melinda said, although I take her point because I think, you know, I think the mandate has a really valid policy purpose. But, you know, I think these are real issues. I don't really belittle the people who are concerned. I mean, they you know, the government has argued in federal court, yes, you know, theoretically we could make you buy broccoli. And government, central government power is a big issue in America and always has been. And I think it is incumbent upon the government to make some argument as to why this is a legal use of federal power that doesn't set a precedent that people need to be worried about. I didn't go to law school. I know nothing about the Supreme Court. I've never stepped inside the place, and I'm sure that argument is to be made by learned jurists. But it is incumbent upon them to make it, and I don't think it's like a black helicopter crowd kind of issue. I think it's an important legal issue. They need to hammer out to validate this law.
Before you both go, Melinda, go ahead.
I don't say that there's no valid argument over the role of government and how far they can go in mandating what we should do. Absolutely not. Having grown up in a family of very staunch conservatives, that is not a new matter for me to think about. However, in hearing the law described as mandating abortion, as the abortion pill mandate, as something that would ration care for preventative care for women with breast cancer.
Right, that's a different thing than the mandate, right?
Those things are entirely false. So
yeah.
I did hear it described in ways that were not about only how far can the government role really go.
Just one thing real quick, Matt, before you go. You conclude in your article that the gridlock may not be as hopeless as it seems going forward. Now, you've made it seem pretty hopeless here today with the lack of trust and rather having the political talking point than the deal. Do you still think so after they passed this partisan budget yesterday?
Yeah, I'm kind of an optimist. I guess if I wouldn't, I'd just go do something else. It'd be too depressing, Brian. You know, I think my point was, I'm not being Pollyannish about it, but my point is, you know, everyone says, well, it's hopeless. Well, you know, this is often how progress does get made. It's several starts and stops. It's walking into walls. I mean, what we know about the Speaker and the President is that they both very badly wanted a deal, personally and politically, that they pushed forward to get a wide array of agreement on a lot of significant issues that you would not have thought they could find agreement on. As I say, about, you know, 80-85% of the way there. And you know that they are facing a serious crisis, a sort of three-pronged crisis at the end of this year, having to do with the sequestration numbers, you know, the automatic budget cuts, the Bush tax cuts, which will expire, another debt limit vote. They're going to be very motivated to get something done. They have this blueprint, and particularly if the president's reelected and knows he has this window to solidify his legacy, and if the speaker looks around and finds that he's lost some of those more extreme members of his caucus who swept in on the wave and then might sweep out again if the president is reelected, then I think they're both going to be motivated and have a little maneuvering room, and if there's enough residual trust there, that would seem to me to be a distinct possibility that they could get something done.
So what you're saying is maybe it should have been John Boehner, who whispered to Medvedev this week that if the president and he get reelected, they'll have more room to get stuff done. Okay, we will leave it there with Matt Bai, whose article, Who Killed the Debt Deal, will be in the Sunday Times Magazine this weekend, and Melinda Henneberger, who is the anchor blogger for the Washington Post's She the People blog. Thank you both very, very much.
Thanks, Brian.
And listeners, in case you're interested, I'll be on television tonight talking about the Supreme Court's health reform hearings and other politics on the New York One Reporters Roundtable around 7:30 and 10:30 tonight on New York One. And coming up next right here, the on-time New York State budget, ready for the April 1st fiscal year. But what the heck is in it? Stay tuned.